Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross at noon today, Terry goes into the archives for an interview that she did with Pete Hamill, the New York City columnist and reporter who died yesterday at the age of 85. I don't know how many papers he ultimately ended up writing for in New York. Could be six. I don't know. They had so many papers when he was in his prime, and it seemed like he worked for all of them. But a gifted wordsmith and a terrific representative of New York and what life in the city was like. Pete Hamill in archived interviews with Terry Gross coming up right here at noon on 89.3 KPCC. As I mentioned right before our break, once we get to the point that we have one or more vaccines for the novel coronavirus that are FDA approved and able to be widely distributed, the question is going to be who should get priority, because obviously you can't do hundreds of millions of vaccinations simultaneously. So there will have to be decision making. And the question is it, you know, hotspots where the virus is causing the greatest number of casualties that you vaccinate first? Is it people that work in frontline healthcare positions? Is it those who have underlying health conditions or are older that are at greater risk of complications? Is it people getting the placebo during the clinical trial because they've made the contribution of doing that? Should they be in one of the first groups to be vaccinated to get the real thing? Joining us to talk about these challenges is professor of psychiatry and director of the Medical Ethics Program at the School of Medicine, UC Irvine, Dr. Aaron Cariotti. Dr. Cariotti, so good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Oh, great to be with you, Larry. And this is a really fascinating and quite complicated topic, so I'm glad we're addressing it.
Yeah, we have so many more people worthy of being, you know, up there at the front of the line than almost certainly are going to be able to be vaccinated immediately. So first of all, what is the process for medical ethicists to work through this and to reach some kind of a national consensus?
So the current state of play on that question is, I think right now, a lot of people on the local and state levels are waiting to see what comes out of the current deliberations from the CDC. And the CDC has commissioned the National Academy of Medicine, which is not in and of itself a governmental entity, but they often consult with the federal government and give recommendations. So they are currently working on this question of vaccine allocation. And at the University of California and with the Office of the President Ethics Work Group that I'm involved with for all the UCs, we are looking at these questions, but also sort of waiting to see what comes out from the federal government, because it's not clear whether they're going to issue more general guidance that will give some leeway for state or local authorities to make particular decisions on the local level. So right now there's kind of a who decides question that's still a bit up in the air. How prescriptive and absolute are the federal guidelines going to be versus how much room is there going to be for large healthcare institutions or county and state public health officials to tailor general guidelines to their particular circumstances? So there's while people are rolling up their sleeves, certainly we are at the University of California, and diving into some of these questions, we're also anticipating that whatever comes out from the CDC and the National Academy of Medicine is going to very heavily shape this conversation.
Also with us is University of Denver Professor of Law, where he focuses on bioethics and health law, Professor Govind Prasad. Dr. Prasad, Professor Prasad, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to getting a chance to speak with you.
From a legal perspective, what are some of the potential minefields here?
So I think a couple of the issues that are likely to come up are one that Dr. Cariotti flagged, which is the question about whether these decisions get made at a state and local level, which traditionally has been the case for public health, and what the federal role is. We've seen some cases already where, for instance, with the allocation of a scarce therapeutic drug, remdesivir, The federal government sort of botched or handled that allocation in a way that was confusing and challenging for state and local. And then the other area is obviously the question of who gets the vaccine first, as opposed to who, what level makes the decisions. And there, I think the two areas where you could get legal issues that arise are if criteria like whether, say, somebody is over 65 are used for deciding who gets vaccine first, and then also if other criteria that are subject to what lawyers call strict legal scrutiny, say, allocating on the basis of race to try to prioritize people from ethnic groups that have been hit harder, that's an area where obviously you would have legal involvement. But that second question is going to depend a lot on what the recommendations end up looking like. Do they end up picking out specific groups that are what, again, lawyers might call protected legal classes for priority?
Yeah, and I could see there'd be a lot of pushback to that, because even if you do it for someone, prioritize someone over the age of 65, you got a lot of very healthy, you know, people in their 60s, even into their 70s, who have no underlying conditions. They've been essentially locked down, not exposing themselves to potential spread of the virus. So should someone like that get a vaccination ahead of a nurse who's working in a COVID ward, maybe 32 years old, at a local hospital?
Yes, I think one of the big questions that we've seen coming up, and one of the reasons why I think you're absolutely right that it doesn't make sense to just use age as a sole criterion, and in fact, using age as the only criterion is something that the, at least Health and Human Services has said they would not regard as legal, is that you're seeing also a major disparities among people under 65 who are dying. The LA Times of the CDC had a recent report on CDC research showing that the big disparities we're seeing by race and economics and who's dying of COVID, a lot of those are being driven by disparities that are just enormous, fivefold and so on, among folks who are under 65, folks like the grocery store worker, bus driver, the nurse that you're talking about.
Yeah, but of course, if you do it by race, I mean, I'm thinking of my wife and son who are Latino, and their risk would be no greater than anyone of any other race or ethnicity, because of based on all the other demographics and their lives. So unless there's some argument that the actual ethnicity of someone, that itself makes them more vulnerable, that would be pretty dicey to just say, well, we're going to do this according to race or ethnicity, wouldn't it?
That's absolutely right. I think you wouldn't want to use just race or ethnicity, because the risk factor here isn't race so much as it is housing exposure, occupational exposure, things that, as you say, can happen to folks of any race, even though they can be exacerbated by structural racism. So I think the way to focus would really be to look at, as you suggest, you know, who is at high risk of exposure that we can't present in other ways because their jobs are risky, their jobs are essential. So again, I think your nurse is a great example of this, to think about who's at high risk of getting and also spreading it to other folks. Maybe they live with folks who are at risk at home. And not only are they at high risk, but we have trouble protecting them in other ways because of the nature of their job.
We're talking with a professor at the University of Denver School of Law, Govind Prasad. Also with us, Dr. Aaron Cariotti, joining us from UC Irvine School of Medicine, where he's an associate professor of psychiatry and director of the Medical Ethics Program at UCI's School of Medicine. I'd love to hear from you your thoughts about how to equitably and most effectively determine who should get vaccination against the novel coronavirus first. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can share your input on this. I'm very interested. There's no right answer here, obviously, as we're hearing. You can make a case for all different classifications. You can sort this almost an infinite number of ways, but I'd like to hear your argument for why you think a particular group should get priority. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Dr. Cariotti, another confounding factor in this is that at least the public opinion polls that I've seen most recently show there may be a quarter of the U.S. population that doesn't want to get vaccinated. They don't think it's safe. They don't have confidence. They're just philosophically opposed to it. So how then does that factor into the prioritization?
Yeah, so that is, I anticipate that's going to be a major issue and a major, it may become sort of a major political fight because I think there are several things going on there that will raise difficult questions about the use of coercion, for example. How much can we nudge individuals and through various incentives encourage or even strongly encourage them to get vaccines versus requiring an adult population, mandating by law, which has actually never been done in the United States before. There have been strong incentives utilized, including work-related incentives. You know, you can't go to work unless you get your vaccine, or you may not be able to travel. But saying that individuals absolutely have to get the vaccine and there are no exemptions or exceptions is not something that's been done in the United States. So that would be crossing a new threshold in terms of, the argument that for public health-related reasons, we can bypass the individual informed consent process and basically remove the rights of individuals to refuse to get a vaccine.
That, for me, just personally, that I'm not comfortable with that. But you as an ethicist, do you think that there could be a compelling case made for forcing people to be vaccinated?
I have not yet seen a compelling case that would convince me. I share your concerns about going that far. I think there are certain incentives, especially for high-risk populations, that are probably ethically justified. There are certain ways to nudge, to educate the public, to encourage them, but crossing the line into coercion could risk further undermining the trust of public health officials. And I think I think a large proportion of those folks that say they don't want a vaccine, some of them are a little bit in the middle. I think you're going to see a lot of people that want to hang back for a little while. They actually don't want to be at the front of the line. So, we're sort of talking about how to prioritize or allocate vaccines in such a way that we decide who is at the front of the line. But one wrinkle is that there may be quite a few folks that want to wait a few months and sort of see what happens once this starts being distributed on a wide scale. Are there adverse events or side effects that weren't seen in the clinical trials that start emerging? So I think some people have safety concerns. They're not absolutely opposed to the vaccine. They just don't want to be sort of in the first tranche of individuals out of the gate to get it. If you force those individuals to get a vaccine or other individuals who may have principled or ethical concerns about the vaccine, for example, one of the ethical concerns are vaccines derived from fetal tissue that was acquired during an abortion. And some of the vaccines in the pipeline fall into that category. Other vaccines don't. So there may be some people that are willing to take vaccine from company X, but not vaccine company Y for moral reasons. Well, if you force something on people and there are harmful or unexpected outcomes, then that could convince already mistrustful individuals who have historical reasons for mistrust of the medical establishment that they were somehow used as involuntary test subjects. Mm-hmm. Certain ethnic groups, for example, that we know have been historically abused by the medical profession in this regard, may see this as another instance of, they said they were going to allocate this to poor minority populations, out of regard for us or out of concern for us. But then there was this adverse reaction that 10% of the people had. And now we feel like we've been played or we've been used once again as a kind of guinea pig in a social experiment.
Yeah, and sadly, this will not be the last case where we'll likely need a vaccination for some sort of a public health threat. Let me briefly go back to law professor, University of Denver, Govind Prasad. Professor Prasad, could it be mandated that people do this? Is that even a legal avenue potentially available?
So it is a legal avenue to mandate a vaccine, but I don't think it should be by any means the first avenue that you look at. And any mandate would need to have, based on Supreme Court precedent, exceptions for, say, folks who might be at medical risk. If you had a vaccine that works well for most people, but say in folks who are immunocompromised or who are allergic to one of the vaccine ingredients, you would need to have exceptions. There's a very famous Supreme Court case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts that says that states are allowed to mandate vaccines so long as they don't go beyond what's reasonably required for public safety. But the question before you get to the point of having a mandate is you have to look at, are there other steps we could take before we get to having to have some type of mandate that, as you talked about earlier, encouraging people, educating folks, offering people options, trying to make vaccines accessible to them safely. You need to sort of show that you're doing that, I think, at least ethically, before you turn to mandating vaccines.
Could you pay people? I mean, that sounds, I realize this sounds so extreme, but legally, could you use public dollars to pay someone to get vaccinated?
Legally, I think there's not an obvious reason why you wouldn't be able to do that. There is a doctrine called the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, where sometimes offering somebody an inducement to give up a right would be unreasonable. I don't think that would be true here because of the fact that the mandate is legally permissible. I think the challenge with paying folks is what I would want to see is good public opinion research and understanding on what would lead people who feel hesitant, who feel uncertain, to feel comfortable taking a COVID-19 vaccine. Is it the money that's an obstacle? What are the obstacles that these folks are encountering? And so the main concern I would have with a financial incentive is, yeah, I want to know more about, would that lead people to be more distrustful?
And let me just clarify for those listening, no one is really talking about, I'm raising this as a theoretical issue. Please don't get alarmed that at this point there's serious talk of compelling people to take the vaccine or paying them to take the vaccine. We're just talking theoretically about this. But what is a very real world concern that's going to be faced as soon as we have one or more vaccines approved for widespread distribution is who should be able to be at the head of the line, who gets priority. 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in just 90 seconds. I'm very concerned. I'm seeing gambling on bobas for when the vice presidential choice from Joe Biden is going to be announced next week. Gambling going on here? Yes, involving bobas. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. It's funny because we set up these sort of, you know, not money involved, but pools on when certain news events are going to be taking place. So fun to see what our production staff comes up with about each major news event. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org, for who should be prioritized for getting vaccination. Matt in Van Nuys, you're on AirTalk.
Hi there, Larry. Thank you for having me.
Go right ahead.
So I think that the weakest links, if you will, have to get vaccinated first, people who are at the highest risk. The frontline workers, of course, in the first round, and in the second round would be at-risk populations such as the elderly, people with pre-existing conditions and the like, and then make the vaccine available for the general public at no cost. I appreciate your point about a financial incentive, but I think that would place undue pressure on lower class individuals who are already in financially dire straits.
Semi-compulsory,
Exactly. And if there's anything unsafe about this vaccine, then a larger amount of that population would be at risk as opposed to people who don't need that financial incentive, for example.
And Matt, would you take the locations where there are larger number of cases into account, or do you think that's less important than people who are more vulnerable and who are out more interacting with other people as essential employees?
You raise location. I think it's a very difficult calculation. Rural areas would probably have to get prioritized because generally speaking, there are fewer hospitals, less available medical care in those regions, whereas here in Los Angeles, we are still doing fairly well, and there are available hospital beds and ventilators and the like.
Matt, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. 866-893-KPCC. Let's talk with Ann in Long Beach. Ann, what do you think should be highest priority?
Well, I think that there's a geographical imperative because we've been talking a lot about who's been hardest hit, Southeast L.A., the rural areas. And I do think that your point about location is very important. If, as we prioritize who should have access, not mandate, but access to the vaccine, I think those areas hardest hit, those zip codes that are historically underserved and have had more cases would obviously rise to the top in my consideration. I live in Long Beach, and zip code does determine health. And we have more asthma, we have more infant mortality in certain areas, in certain zip codes. And I think geography plays an enormous role in deciding access to a vaccine.
Ann, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing that. Let me go back to Dr. Aaron Cariotti, UC Irvine School of Medicine. Your thoughts on these first couple of listener calls?
Yeah, so I appreciate both comments from both of the listeners, and these are strong and compelling arguments. Just because I like complicating things, I will add a few wrinkles to their comments. One would be, if we go by zip code, or we go by individuals that have, or populations that have been harder hit, that's going to include prisoners, as it turns out. And having a prison in your zip code that has had a major outbreak could push your numbers way up as compared to the general population. So we know that the largest outbreaks have been in nursing homes and have been in prisons. Half the people who died in New York were nursing home residents. So if we're looking at places that have been hit hardest or populations that have been hit hardest, I think most Americans would probably, you know, maybe after prioritizing critical workers, would probably think it's sensible to try to prioritize individuals in nursing homes. That gets a little complicated when you talk about trying to save the most number of lives, because someone in a nursing home may have stage 4 cancer and may not be expected to live more than another 6 months to a year. So is that an individual who should be prioritized for a vaccine? It's kind of an interesting question.
Yeah.
And then when you talk about, you know, prioritizing prisoners before prioritizing people that are waiting to get a vaccine so that they can go back to work, I think that could certainly stir up controversy among Americans in terms of the principles underlying prioritization and how they play out in terms of specific populations.
Noah in Riverside says, I'm concerned mostly about the safety of the vaccine because of how rushed the process has been. I think if we're giving the vaccine to vulnerable populations first, that would be dangerous. Noah, I appreciate that. Govind Prasad, professor, University of Denver, you have a quick thought on that?
Approval process. I think it's really going to be essential for the approval process for whichever vaccine or vaccines ends up being effective to be trustworthy and not politicized. It needs to be based on ideally sort of reliable evidence from randomized controlled trials that shows both greater safety and greater efficacy. And I think without that evidence, absolutely, if you get a rush to getting a vaccine approved by some set date for political reasons, you absolutely would worry that vulnerable populations might be either injured by the vaccine, or I also worry about people take a vaccine that ends up not being effective. They think they're protected, and they miss out on what a better vaccine could have been that could have saved many lives.
And Dr. Cariotti, we're almost out of time, but your thoughts on this? I mean, any vaccine is still going to have to go through the multiple phases, right?
It will, but there is still a difference between giving a vaccine to 30,000 research subjects and giving it to millions of people. So a very rare adverse effect that may not show up in a smaller clinical trial could become manifest when the numbers get orders of magnitude larger. You know, one final wrinkle is some vaccines may require multiple doses. Maybe you only get sort of 50% reduction of risk with your first dose of the vaccine, and then you need a booster shot to, you know, to get you in the 95% protected category. Do we give everyone one shot to reduce their risk, or do we give half the number of people both shots to reduce their risk more significantly? Could be another interesting and difficult question if the vaccine that's approved turns out to require more than one dose for full efficacy.
Dr. Cariotti, I thought this was a difficult enough topic coming into it. You've just made this much more challenging for us to deal with. So many serious considerations here once we have vaccines that are approved to be given to the population widespread. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Aaron Cariotti, UC Irvine School of Medicine, where he directs the Medical Ethics Program. And our thanks to law professor, University of Denver, Govind Prasad as well, who focuses on bioethics and the law. Coming up on Air Talk, we'll take a look at controversies over mask wearing during a pandemic. In this case, the controversy goes back longer than a century. It's Air Talk on KPCC, back in 1 minute.